WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is committed to helping you understand the truth behind the news. Now, here's your host, Paul Dragoo.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today is Friday, May 12th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. The entire country now knows about our border breakdown. And for the most part, Americans are deeply concerned. And for good reason. Border jumping shot up from already high levels during the final days of Title 42. And now that Title 42 expired last night, it could get much worse. But the border crisis didn't spring out of nowhere. It's certainly not a recent development. The magnitude of today's crisis was predictable. For at least the last 50 years, only Donald Trump's efforts to secure the border have deviated from an otherwise consistently insane policy that has allowed in so many illegal migrants. The New American has been warning about the worsening border crisis for decades. Back in 1986, The New American's William Jasper wrote, quote, "If the immigration situation sounds alarming now, we can expect it soon to get much worse." How much worse? Quote, "In Mexico and the Central American countries alone, there are more than 100 million people. And as the political and economic structures of those nations continue to deteriorate due to socialist policies, a sizable percentage of that population can be expected to arrive at our doorstep. South America, Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and Europe will contribute legions more," end quote. The same 1986 article warned that amnesty, then being considered by Congress, quote, "rewards the lawbreaker and will encourage continued lawbreaking by setting a precedent and creating an anticipation and expectation of future amnesties," end quote. Of course, that's exactly what has happened. 2 years later, in 1988, Bill Jasper scripted and produced a one-hour video documentary for the John Birch Society, the New American's parent organization, called Out of Control, The Immigration Invasion. So for today's show, we're shown an abridged version of that 1988 film, Out of Control. It is spot on even today because its warnings about our suicidal immigration policies were not heeded. You may be impressed how well the documentary has held up against the test of time. After we showed the documentary, Bill Jasper, who's now a senior editor for The New American, will join us for an important discussion about why we've allowed and even brought on the border breakdown. We'll also discuss what can be done. We'll take a quick break, and when we return, we'll play the documentary.
The John Birch Society has been working tirelessly since 1958 to preserve freedom, safeguard the Constitution, and restore our God-given rights. We continually educate voters and lead the freedom movement. Join us as we work against a tyrannical one-world government. United as one, we can defeat this conspiracy against a free America. JBS founder Robert Welch said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Join us in restoring this great nation.
Imprisonment, forced labor, permanent separation from my family. Perhaps death. I knew what could happen to people who were caught trying to defect. But the watchtowers stood yards away. The possibility of a new life in a different world, one without tyranny, was within sight. The West. I thought of the rewards no longer crushed under the boot of communism. I would work and make money, no longer restrained by the chains of collectivism. I would say what I wanted, without fear of spies and informants nearby. I would be free. The frozen rain and Romanian mud seeped from my gloves and cloths. I fantasized about a fire burning in the wood stove of my parents' home. But I pushed those thoughts from my mind, closed my eyes, and waited for the cover of the darkness.
Get Defector, a true story of tyranny, liberty, and purpose by Mark Hobovkovich with Paul Dragoo. A thrilling page-turner that will remind you how precious yet vulnerable freedom is. Available at shopjbs.org or Amazon. For a limited time, get 20% off your entire order using promo code DEFECTOR20 when you purchase Defector at shopjbs.org.
back.
You're not going to get a ride back.
You are witnessing an invasion, an ongoing invasion that has been escalating for over a decade. The scenes you are watching are typical of what can be seen daily at hundreds of points all along our southern border, where each day thousands of people from countries all over the world enter the United States illegally. All of these people are on U.S. soil in violation of our law. Most illegal aliens enter along the U.S.-Mexican border. Some are smuggled across in secret compartments in some of the thousands of vehicles that cross the border each day. Others will enter using forged documents. Still others will fly into this country on student or tourist visas and never leave. The vast majority, however, will simply wade in, swim in, or walk in. Their chances of escaping apprehension are quite good. The U.S. Border Patrol is too short on men and resources even to give chase in many instances. Even so, for 6 years running now, the Border Patrol has apprehended well over 1 million illegal aliens per year. In 1986, the Border Patrol's arrests totaled 1.8 million. That's nearly 2 million people caught entering this country in violation of our law in a single year. By the most conservative and optimistic estimates, one or two illegal aliens successfully penetrate our border and escape inland for each illegal who is arrested and deported. Border Patrol officers all along our southern front have told us that the ratio is really much higher, more on the order of 4 or 5 to 1. That means that, at the least, well over 1 million illegal aliens make it into this country annually. And more likely, the total is closer to several million. As long ago as 1975, then Commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, General Leonard Chapman, warned that illegal immigration is out of control. The following year, Commissioner Chapman said, there are today in the United States 6 to 8 million illegal aliens, and that number is increasing by 500,000 to 1 million each year. Despite the growing crisis, Congress refused to act. In October 1983, President Reagan was merely stating what had been painfully obvious for many years when he said, "This country has lost control of its own borders, and no country can sustain that kind of position." The President and Congress finally responded to this crisis by enacting the controversial and badly misnamed Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. They assured us that this would remedy the problem. That bill is now law, but the invasion continues on a massive scale. In 1956, U.S. Border Patrol arrested 87,696 foreign nationals entering this country illegally. Apprehensions in 1966 reached over 138,000. A decade later, in 1976, they topped 1 million. By the end of 1986, they were approaching 2 million per year. The number of arrests dipped in 1987, due largely to the removal of Border Patrol agents from the border to work on the newly passed employer sanctions and other new programs. This notwithstanding, the Border Patrol still expelled over 1.2 million illegal aliens in 1987. 1988 will be another million plus year. No one knows for sure just how many foreign nationals have illegally entered the United States and taken up residence here on a permanent or semi-permanent basis. As we have previously noted, INS Commissioner Chapman put the total at 6 to 8 million. That was back in 1976. President Jimmy Carter replaced General Chapman with Leonel J. Castillo. Castillo attempted to downplay the seriousness of the situation by claiming that there were only 3 to 6 million illegals in the U.S. The Independent Select Commission on Immigration and Refugee Policy, established by Congress in 1978, estimated the total to be around 8 million. Maurice C. Inman, General Counsel for the INS, stated in 1986 that 12 to 15 million is a more realistic figure. The Liberal Environmental Fund claims that 20 million is closer to the mark. Regardless of which figures one accepts, the numbers involved are staggering, An influx of this magnitude over such a short time has enormous economic, social, political, and national security ramifications. We will examine those shortly, but please keep in mind that the numbers we've been discussing thus far deal only with illegal immigrants. During this same period that we've been experiencing such large-scale violation of our borders, we've also been welcoming a record number of legal immigrants to our shores. By the end of 1989, we will have set an all-time record of 9 million new immigrants admitted in one decade. The United States has been traditionally, and remains today, the most liberal country in the world with regard to immigration. In fact, we accept twice as many immigrants annually as all of the other nations of the world combined. But is it in our interest to continue those policies which allow and encourage immigration on such a large scale? Merely asking this question incites cries of discrimination, xenophobia, and racism from some quarters. We are reminded that we are a nation of immigrants and are told that it is selfish, inhumane, and even un-American to restrict the flow of those who wish to come to this land. The Statue of Liberty, we are told, is our statement to the world that we will accept all of their poor and huddled masses. We are indeed a nation of immigrants, and we're rightfully proud of our distinctive heritage, rich in the cultures, tongues, and contributions of peoples from many nations. For more than three centuries, America has been a refuge and a beacon, indeed a magnet, to peoples the world over. During the 18th and 19th centuries, there was little reason to be concerned about immigration. America had vast open frontiers and was in need of new hands that were willing to work. Even though there were few restrictions placed on immigration during the first century of our republic, there was never any question that immigration to this country was a privilege, not a right. There are those now, however, who claim that immigration is indeed a right. This notion, of course, is absurd. As a sovereign nation, the people of the United States, through their elected representatives, have a right to determine who may immigrate to this country and to establish the criteria for admission. This is the right of all sovereign nations. This was clearly recognized by America's founding fathers. Our Constitution, in Article 1, Section 8, gives to Congress the power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. The United States Supreme Court in 1875 ruled that state laws regulating immigration were unconstitutional. Clearly, immigration matters are the responsibility of the federal government. The individual states are neither empowered nor equipped to deal with this matter. Article 4, Section 4 of our Constitution says this: "The United States shall guarantee to every state in this Union a republican form of government, and shall protect each of them against invasion." The federal government, however, has been ignoring its constitutional mandate regarding these vital responsibilities, while at the same time involving itself in many other areas for which there is no constitutional justification. Our government in Washington, for instance, is spending tens of billions of dollars and employing tens of thousands of individuals in the departments of energy, education, and health and human services, while allowing our borders to go unprotected. The Federal Department of Education has 4,500 employees on payroll and a budget in excess of $20 billion. The Department of Energy, with an employee force of over 16,000, has a budget of $13.7 billion. Then there's the Department of Health and Human Services, with a whopping manpower pool of more than 116,000 and a budget of $375 billion. By contrast, the INS, including the Border Patrol, operates out of the Department of Justice on less than $1 billion and a workforce that is due to increase to slightly above 5,000 by the end of 1988. With these relatively puny resources, the INS and Border Patrol are charged with securing our thousands of miles of border, inspecting several million places of employment, and maintaining records on millions of foreign visitors. Along our 2,000-mile border with Mexico, where over 95% of our illegal alien arrests are made, the Border Patrol has been operating with less than 2,500 officers. In real terms, that has meant that during a normal work shift, no more than 500 to 600 agents are actually manning our entire southern border. And oftentimes, the number is even far lower than that. By the end of 1988, they're scheduled to be augmented to a total of 3,600 officers, a significant increase, but still far from adequate. By contrast, New York City has a police force of nearly 27,000 officers. Los Angeles has nearly 7,400 men in uniform. The border fence, erected in 1975 at a cost of $5 million, is now intact in only a few heavily guarded places. The vehicles you see passing by just a few feet on the other side of this stretch of fence near San Diego are on the Ensenada Highway in Tijuana, Mexico. Smugglers have clipped the fence, leaving just a flap that a car or truck can drive through. Appropriately, someone has painted this sign on the border fence at Imperial Beach, San Diego. Sin fronteras means without borders, and on most days you can see illegals starting their journey north here along the Pacific Ocean. Sophisticated technology plays an important role in border enforcement. This is the computer control center at the Border Patrol station near San Diego. Signals from hundreds of motion detector sensors buried in the ground are transmitted to this room, and these operators then relay to the agents in the field the locations at which foot traffic or vehicular traffic has been detected. But on most days, the traffic is so heavy that there are just not enough officers in the field to respond. Night scopes, such as the one you see here, are also tremendous aids to the Border Patrol, but manpower shortages often preclude their use. Why? A scope requires the deployment of two officers, one to operate the scope and the other to stand guard so that the operator is not attacked and overpowered by illegal aliens or by the bandits who prey upon the aliens. Our men and women in green are in constant danger to life and limb, and nearly all carry visible battle scars. For their personal safety, they should be assigned to the field in two-man teams, but the standard is still one officer per vehicle. These lone agents, often with inoperable radios and vehicles of dubious reliability, regularly patrol remote and dangerous areas where they may be outnumbered by as much as 100 to 1. Along some stretches of our border, our officers dare not venture except in war wagons, outfitted with special screens for protection against the barrages of rocks, bottles, and chunks of metal or concrete. Our thin green line is being overwhelmed. They simply can't keep up with the ever-rolling tide of aliens. Every hour of every day, busloads of Mexican nationals are returned to the border and released back into Mexico. Within hours, many of them will be back in the United States. Rain or shine, day or night, 365 days a year, the invasion continues. This is our port of entry at San Ysidro, California, which handles some 12 million vehicle crossings and 10 million pedestrian crossings a year. The story is much the same at El Paso, Texas, our second busiest port of entry, and at Brownsville, Laredo, Hidalgo, Calexico, Nogales, and many other ports. Much smuggling of both drugs and aliens goes undetected because we have the enforcement manpower for only cursory, sporadic checks of vehicles and foot traffic. In most areas, customs officers are limited to approximately 30 seconds per vehicle and only a couple of seconds per person. Because of this ease of entry, people from all over the world come to Mexico to slip into the U.S. illegally. Foreign nationals from more than 100 countries are apprehended annually on our southern border. The vast majority of illegal aliens enter this country at those relatively few areas along our border where the Mexican and U.S. cities have grown almost together. With no real barriers, they can quickly cross over into San Diego, El Paso, or Brownsville, for instance, and blend into the local population. This involves no more than about 100 miles of our border, where most of the illegal trafficking takes place. Simply putting up a well-patrolled, double-fenced borderline through these areas would curtail most of the invasion we're experiencing. Let's look at some of the ramifications of this massive influx of both legal and illegal immigrants. One of the very important factors today in the immigration equation that was absent when earlier immigrant waves hit these shores is our gargantuan welfare state. Previous generations of immigrants arrived here as destitute as any of those arriving today. They had to work to survive. There was no alternative. There was no free lunch. What assistance was available came from friends, relatives, church, and private charities. That is a far cry from today. This booklet, El Otro Lado, has been distributed by the thousands to illegal aliens. Translated, it says, The Other Side, a guide for the undocumented. It's published by the radical left group in Albuquerque, New Mexico, called the Resource Center. This guide provides the illegal aliens with an extensive list of organizations with addresses and telephone numbers, many of them toll-free, in almost every state in the Union that they can contact for legal assistance in fighting deportation. They are told how to apply for all of the welfare and medical benefits available to them in this welfare wonderland. Another radical document, the so-called Bill of Rights for the Undocumented Worker, is distributed widely to illegal aliens by farm workers' unions, legal aid organizations, so-called immigrants' rights groups, and liberal churches. Article 5 of this Bill of Rights states, Every immigrant worker shall fully enjoy all the rights guaranteed to citizen workers, including socioeconomic and labor rights. Article 7 demands that every immigrant worker shall be guaranteed the same rights enjoyed by U.S. citizens, especially the right of access to free and adequate social and health services, child care, and other similar social benefits. Every immigrant worker shall have the right to vote in local and state elections without having to become citizens. Many immigrants' rights activists claim this right for federal elections as well, and they are taking advantage of our overall lax registration process to sign up numerous non-citizen voters. The County of Los Angeles, with the largest illegal alien population in the country, has an extensive $1 million a year voter outreach program. It involves the distribution of postcard voter forms at 3,500 locations, 85 full-time bilingual registrars, and 24-hour toll-free telephone help, all in an effort to increase the number of minority, and especially Hispanic, voters. But even this is not aggressive enough to satisfy some. Attorneys for the American Civil Liberties Union, representing the organization Common Cause, brought suit against the county, claiming that it was not doing everything possible to register all eligible ethnic minority members. Incredible as it may seem, Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Jack M. Newman ruled in favor of the plaintiffs and ordered the county to deputize some 20,000 county employees to sign up voters. If his judgment stands, it will almost certainly result in the registration of many thousands of non-citizens. A final judgment has not been rendered in this case yet, but the fact that a suit of this sort could be brought in the first place and then sustained through the appeals process all the way to the state high court is alarming evidence of the degree to which the subversives are succeeding in changing the very definition of rights in America. At this rate, the day may not be far off when Article 2 of the so-called Bill of Rights for the Undocumented Worker is accepted as the law of the land. That article states, Every immigrant worker shall have all of the constitutional rights guaranteed all persons in the U.S. and shall be free from deportations and other unconstitutional practices. In other words, those who come here in violation of our laws shall have all the rights of citizenship and shall dictate to us the terms of their stay here. Another very important dimension of our immigration crisis is the very real threat that it poses to our national security. If millions of illegal alien peasants can slip across our border, isn't it reasonable to assume that foreign terrorists, agents of hostile powers, even Soviet Spetsnaz commandos could do the same thing? We will examine the national security threat in part two of this program.
I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. I mean, whoa. Who knows what would come out of that?
Just imagine if we have a constitutional convention, the number of people who will be unhappy and the number of people who say the results are not valid, and then they'll just ignore the entire Constitution.
What we need are just more people that would read the one we have.
It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It is the people who ignore the Constitution that usurp power and abuse the constitutional power that they ostensibly have.
If you can't enforce an existing piece of paper, how are you going to enforce a piece of paper that has a little more writing to it? In other words, it's been amended.
It's up to us to hold our elected officials accountable.
What can you do to elect good representatives and senators in your state legislature who understand the Constitution and are willing to take a stand?
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.
Congress finally did respond to the mounting crisis by passing the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, now often referred to as IRCA, or the Simpson-Rodino Act, after its principal authors, Senator Alan Simpson and Congressman Peter Rodino. Retired INS investigator Carl Nelson served 25 years with the Border Patrol and the INS in Texas, New York, and California. Like most of his colleagues, he sees IRCA as a colossal disaster.
But Congress abrogated their responsibility during the whole time. And finally, when they did something, it was like in the military. Do something even if it's wrong. And they did.
The new law has three main features. Amnesty, also known as legalization, employer sanctions, and enhanced enforcement. Under the general amnesty provision, those aliens who have resided here illegally since before 1982 are eligible for legalization. By the application cutoff date of May 4, 1988, 1,760,163 aliens had applied for this amnesty. A second amnesty program called SAW, S-A-W, for seasonal agricultural workers, is available to illegal aliens who worked in agriculture for at least 90 days between May 1985 and May 1986. The INS expects 900,000 to apply for the SAW amnesty before the application deadline. The program has been marked by widespread fraud. At many legalization centers, like this one in Harlingen, Texas, ineligible aliens arrive from Mexico daily, often even in cars with Mexican license plates, and apply for amnesty with phony documents. The employer sanctions make it illegal for an employer to hire any alien not authorized to work in the U.S., and requires all employers to verify that all of their employees are either U.S. citizens or that they have legal permission to work here.
And I remember in the mid-70s discussing it with my fellow employees in the Los Angeles office, and statements being made like, well, when this thing comes to a head, we're going to have more government. We're going to get another law that's going to put the blame upon the businessman, who of course did not create the problem. He may have benefited from it, some of those people, but they didn't create the problem. But they were going to be given the burden of proof, and there was going to be a law against them. We felt that was true in the mid-70s. It's now come true with the new immigration law, which makes the Immigration Service like any other regulatory agency over business. And we've come that far.
The enforcement provisions in the law proposed a 50% budget increase for the INS and Border Patrol, which, as we discussed in our first segment, is far from adequate, considering the magnitude of the crisis on our borders and the overwhelming demands placed on our immigration officers. The Immigration Reform and Control Act was, in reality, a sellout to the commercial interests that benefit from illegal alien labor and the professional agitators at the American Civil Liberties Union, the National Lawyers Guild, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, the United Farm Workers, the Communist Party, and the Revolutionary Communist Party. So one might expect that the noisy immigrant rights lobby would be pleased with their accomplishment, and with the 2.5 million soon-to-be-legalized aliens in the amnesty programs. However, they are far from satisfied. As they see it, the amnesty program is too restrictive and should be expanded to allow for the legalization of many more aliens. These groups are involved now in many court challenges that are forcing the INS to accept for legalization many thousands more aliens who did not qualify for amnesty. Actually, many of these revolutionaries are committed to the total abolition of our immigration laws and the obliteration of our border. This is evident by their continuous harassing litigation through which they tie up the INS and the immigration courts. It is evident also from their literature and their strategy conferences, such as this Break Down the Border conference held in April 1987 at the Hermanos Escobar Agricultural School in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, and the University of Texas at El Paso. The conference endorsers and attendees included many of the leading figures in the radical Hispanic and immigrant rights network. Marxist agitators also promote the concept of Aztlan, or Mex-America. Aztlan is an Aztecan word referring to a large area of the American Southwest they call the Chicano homeland. Aztlan was stolen by the Anglos, say the propagandists, but the Chicanos will take it back when they become the majority, through illegal immigration. Most Americans of Mexican descent don't subscribe to this subversive notion, but it is growing among the Hispanic population of the Southwest as these separatist extremists step up their militant propaganda. It's not Hispanics only, but all immigrants groups who are being agitated to demand their cultural and linguistic rights. With the assistance of the ACLU and publicly funded legal service attorneys, they've won lawsuits forcing the government to provide ballots and numerous publications, documents, and services, including public schooling, in dozens of foreign languages. This is not only very costly, but even more important, it is extremely divisive. It removes much of the incentive for our newer arrivals to learn the common language of the land that allows our diverse peoples to communicate with one another and maintain a harmonious and civil society. It is also a disservice to the immigrants, whose opportunities for full participation in our political and economic system are severely restricted by the inability to read and speak English.
I'm an American. I'm not a Mexican American. I'm not a Hawaiian American or a Native American or an Afro-American. There's only one type of American, and that's an American citizen. And people must realize that we are deliberately being manipulated from the concept of being a melting pot society to a salad bowl of diversity. We are being encouraged to polarize ourselves from each other. And as has happened in the past with many other social engineering experiments by government liberals and lobbyists and special interest groups, they are trying to take the responsibility of providing a specific element of one's life under government control. As far as I am concerned, heritage is something that should be practiced and encouraged and stimulated in the home, not in the marketplace. When we go out into the marketplace, we speak the language of the land, and the language of the land should be a common language. And as far as I'm concerned, that language is English. The perpetuation of the concept of bilingual education and biculturalism under government mandate is a very dangerous concept, because what you are doing is you're creating an atmosphere where people do not feel that they have to assimilate. They can create these pseudo-nationalist movements and loyalties. Good example of where this has backfired in other countries has been the French Quebec separatist movement in Canada. Back in Africa, there have been various tribes and ethnic groups that have carried their spirit of heritage and nationalism to the point of warfare. To create this unity, to provide a strong government, to provide a strong citizenry, to perpetuate the ideas of freedom as a republic, requires a common language and a common bond and a common heritage, which is the United States of America, American citizenship.
In January 1987, agents of the FBI and INS in Los Angeles arrested 8 individuals connected with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, an extreme militant wing of the PLO terrorist group. Deportation proceedings against the 8 have been tied up by ACLU attorneys for nearly 2 years. Meanwhile, the 8 defendants are out on bail. and Hollywood celebrities and the media champion their cause. What can be done? First of all, we must recognize that we've arrived at our present predicament because the silent majority has been just that, silent, while the vocal, radical minority has maintained a high-pressure, high-visibility campaign, including a steady barrage of letters and communications to Congress. Find out how your representative voted on amnesty and other immigration votes. If he sided with those who are committed to breaking down the border, set to work to change his voting habits, or vote him out of office. Demand that your senators and representative support legislation to prevent the counting of illegal aliens and other non-citizens in the census for congressional representation. There will be continuing pressure to grant additional amnesties to those illegal aliens not already covered by the present amnesties, and to continue expanding our legal immigration quotas. We must register overwhelming opposition to these proposals and soundly defeat them. Congress must pass legislation to prevent the massive chain migration that is certain to occur when the millions of newly legalized aliens are soon eligible to bring in their family members. Under current law, there is no waiting period and no numerical restriction on the number of immediate family members who may be brought in. Unless this exemption is removed and family members are included in a total immigration quota, we may soon be faced with having to accept several million legal immigrants in a single year. So-called free trade zone bills that blur border distinctions, that dilute U.S. sovereignty, and subsidize the relocation of American companies to the Mexican borderlands must be stopped. Student visas should be much more closely monitored, and educational institutions should be required to inform the INS when foreign students graduate or terminate their courses of study. Those individuals, organizations, and churches that participate in the so-called sanctuary movement should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law and should lose their tax-exempt status. If it's determined that foreign agricultural workers are indeed needed for the harvesting of certain crops, then a program that provides for regulated entry of temporary workers, similar to our old Bracero program, can be instituted. It's not necessary to sacrifice the security of our borders merely to get our produce to market. Securing our borders and enforcing our immigration laws must be made a priority issue with our federal officials. The Immigration and Naturalization Service, the Border Patrol, and the Customs Service must be given the manpower and the resources to carry out the jobs they are mandated to perform. In those border areas, like the San Diego-Tijuana sector, where Mexican and American communities have grown together, credible barriers, such as a double fence with a lighted, well-patrolled roadway in between, must be erected. Finally, we must recognize that U.S. foreign policy over the past several decades has been responsible for much of our immigration invasion. The mass migrations occurring now consist primarily of those who are fleeing the brutality of communism and the poverty of socialism. Most of these migrants would prefer to remain in their own countries if conditions there were more tolerable. The most sensible and compassionate thing we could do then is to support those movements, individuals, and organizations that are trying to free their homelands from the ravages of collectivism. Unfortunately, our government directly and indirectly supports those communist and socialist regimes most responsible for the enormous displacements of population. It's the U.S.-imposed socialist programs under U.S.-backed President Duarte, for instance, that have destroyed El Salvador's economy and brought hundreds of thousands of Salvadorans to this country. Successive U.S. administrations have supported the ruling Socialist Party of Mexico, the PRI, even as it nationalized virtually the entire private sector and plundered the economy. As a result, millions have fled north. And even though we can't accept all of these economic refugees, we can hardly blame them for trying to come here. The same can be said for refugees from communist oppression. If not for the enormous economic and technological aid which it receives from the United States, the Soviet Union could not maintain its communist satellites in Cuba and Nicaragua, which are destabilizing our entire Western Hemisphere. Unless we stop our elected officials from supporting communist and socialist regimes and movements, the immigrant refugee flood is certain to swell much larger. These reforms that we offer are moderate, reasonable, practical, and affordable, and they are essential to regaining control of our borders and preserving our political and economic system. Ultimately, it comes down to this. We should either abandon our borders altogether, even the very concept of borders, and allow anyone and everyone who wishes to enter to do so, and then accept the consequences of such a policy. Or we should establish reasonable criteria and quotas, and an orderly process for entry, and then commit sufficient manpower and resources to enforce the law.
Well, one of the conditions that these people are claiming is that if a person pays taxes, let's say he buys a pack of cigarettes, buys a gallon of gasoline, or makes any purchase that involves taxes, or he pays rent, and his, of course, his landlord pays property taxes, this entitles him the illegal to vote because he is now a taxpayer. What you're seeing is a concerted effort to create the largest minority voting bloc this country has ever seen by the year 2000. Because the left, as we know it, believes that the power in this country lies in Congress, and that's true. And by controlling the majority of the congressional seats, you only need about 100,000 qualified voters in each congressional district to do this. You can control this country, which means that you can legally dismantle this country as we have known it and recreate it in a Marxist or socialist manner any way you want and do it legally. And that's their intent.
Hello, I'm Brandon House. Does your family have an emergency freeze-dried food supply on hand? With all that's going on in the world today, why would you not? We have attacks on our power grid, our banking system. We have the actual threat of a banking collapse. Of course, people are talking World War III, chemical spills, and so much more. I've had an emergency freeze-dried food supply on hand for my family since 2013. And then we began offering it to our audience as a service to them. But it's also a big part of our general operating budget. So thank you for purchasing it from us. We can help you and you can help us. We all win. So let me tell you about it. You can order it right now and get free freight. We're offering free freight. For some of you, that's going to save you hundreds of dollars because you're ordering a 1-year supply and a 2-year supply. And we're offering free freight. So you can order it at WVWTVstore.com. That's WVWTVstore.com. You can also call and talk to someone over the phone, and they'll answer all your questions and take your order, track it all the way to your front door. That number is 901-468-9357. We have the gluten-free kit right here available, and it comes in the individual pouches of the individual entrees. Easy to make, easy instructions to follow. We have a 3-month, 6-month, 1-year, 2-year mega protein kit with real meat and the ultimate breakfast program as well. All the details, WVWTVstore.com. It has a 25-year shelf life, as I said, but we offer more than just freeze-dried food. We offer also emergency supplies. We've thought about the things you're going to need should the power go out or there's a crisis, like a little stove. All you need is a little bit of kindling, start a fire, use that stove, and then the custom pot goes on top to boil the water. We also have the water purifiers, as well as hand crank and solar radios and flashlights. Everything's available for you to check out now at WVWTVstore.com or using the number on our screen. Thank you.
Joining me is William Bill F. Jasper, senior editor of The New American and the producer of the movie that we just watched. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Paul. Pleasure being here.
Hey, so I got to say, I don't know what aged better, you or the documentary. It's unfortunate for the documentary, not so unfortunate for you. It was fun watching that, by the way. Well, fun, maybe not. It was fun watching you.
It's kind of embarrassing for me.
I love the glasses, by the way. I hope you still have them. Oh, now you got different ones. So there, you know what? One of the things that caught my eye in that documentary was that interview that you did from that DOJ official with the last name of Rodriguez. I forget what his first name was. And there was that part in there where he talked about He talked about this thing, how we need as a nation, we need a common language and a common heritage and citizenry and whatnot. And, you know, he's like, we're not against, it's not necessarily, there's nothing against being, you know, Mexican at home or things like that. And it really resonated with me because I'm Romanian. So at home and whatnot, it's like, we're Romanian. We speak Romanian here and there with my parents and whatnot. And we eat Romanian food. But we also, he used that word that you're not allowed to use today either. And that's assimilation. We understood when we came here that there, as we're going to assimilate as Americans, and we were proud to do that. That doesn't seem to be an instruction or an admonition that is happening today. And what he said seemed to be that this is going to, his conclusion was that this would destroy the nation. Like a nation without a common heritage and language can't last. It sure seems like that is exactly what we're watching, huh?
Absolutely. Yes, Mike Rodriguez. He is Hispanic background. His parents were Mexican. But he's, as you said, he's an American first. When you come here to this country, if you or I move to another country and take up residence there and become citizens, we're expected then to become full-fledged citizens and not to have divided loyalties and to attempt to fit in and assimilate to the culture there. And that's reasonable, and that's pretty much what's expected everywhere. Mm-hmm. But those who are trying to divide us, that who are trying to destroy this country and turn us against each other, he said it very well.
Yeah, he did.
He was very instrumental in helping me down in the Rio Grande Valley. He had lived there his whole life, and he and a number of other residents of the area helped me when I was filming down there and put me in touch with people on both sides of the border. And but it got so dangerous down there for him 20 years ago, 30 years ago, that he moved out of there and moved up north for the safety of him and his family, his wife and children. So because he was exposing back at that time what was going on.
Yeah. I also found it interesting, and I think this is still happening, obviously, is all these organizations within the United States who were working to provide cover for and you know, invite over illegal immigrants. Who are these, some of the organizations today? You had mentioned ACLU in this documentary. I think that still applies. Has any of that changed? Are there more? Are there less? Are they more blatant?
Unfortunately, the number of organizations has multiplied because, as with so many other things with these activists, NGOs, and organizations, if you follow the money, you find that these are astroturf, synthetic organizations. They are not really grassroots. Today, people focus a lot on George Soros and his Open Societies Foundations, which have funded so many radical activist organizations, including the Breakdown the Border organizations. Mm-hmm. But before he came online, the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundations were the principal sources of most of the radical anti-border, pro-migration organizations. And that is still true today. But the whole purpose of these tax-exempt radical foundations has been to start groups and then to get the taxpayers directly paying for it by getting grants from government agencies. So Health and Human Services, Department of Energy, all these different federal agencies are also providing your tax dollars to these radical organizations. And as we touch on in the video and we've developed in other articles, churches also, all of the radical leftist churches playing upon the sympathies of their congregations have taken money from these congregants and given them to these organizations whose stated purpose is to, as we demonstrate in the video, to break down the border and to claim that anyone coming here has a right. They have a right to vote. They have a right to welfare. They have a right to have their children educated here, to have us taxpayers pay for their children to be delivered and hospital care, all of that.
And how does this also jive with the idea of having this Canada, U.S., Mexico unity, this region? Does that play a role in here? Are there plans? Are they all working together?
Absolutely. The whole push for NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, to combine or to merge Canada, Mexico, and the United States economically and with trade policy. Unfortunately, that's one of the programs that President Trump rightfully denounced and said he wanted to get rid of, but he replaced it with the U.S. MCA and U.S. Mexico Canada agreement. And there are some things in it which may benefit us, but ultimately NAFTA and the U.S. MCA create international structures which override national sovereignty. And in a number of different areas, in business, trade, and immigration. And so we are going to have continuing problems with that. Right now, what all the Democrats and even many of the Republicans are pushing is that, yes, we need to fix our immigration system. We need to have a path for regularization of these people. So what they're talking about now is more amnesties. And as we predicted, we fought IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which President Reagan signed because he had a lot of big Republican donors that were saying, yeah, we need the cheap labor here. And so we said that this was going to be terribly destructive. And that's what happened. And we said it would generate the impetus for future amnesties. And so we've had a repetition of new amnesties, and everyone then brings in people who then have family members and constituents that they want to bring in. So it creates momentum for even more amnesty.
There was some interesting statistics, and I'd be afraid to see what those look like today. You had mentioned the crime statistics of San Diego, Orange County, and then Santa Ana and Fullerton, and the numbers that that you had mentioned were just surprising. I mean, for instance, in Santa Ana, you said 90% of narcotic traffic was committed by illegals, where in Fullerton, 80% of that. And then, of course, you have a third of rapes and murders in San Diego. Do you think those numbers have only gotten worse, or have they held consistent as far as crime being committed by illegal aliens?
They've gotten worse. And what, in addition to that, you know, these statistics that we mentioned here and back at that time were primarily focused on California, Arizona, Texas, where we had the biggest influxes of illegal aliens. Now they've been spread clear across the whole United States, and with it, all of the drug cartels' networks for bringing in all of their, not just drugs, but all other kinds of contraband, including all of their sex slave traffic.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it's gotten worse by
absolutely. I sat in on a DEA press conference once, and they had this map showing, I think at the time there were two things. They were saying fentanyl was on its way, but I think it was meth that was big too. And they were saying it was all coming from three various corridors in Mexico, and it was going through various ways. And it was saying almost all of it was coming from there, you know. And then when Trump said it, you know, they're bringing in drugs and rapists and things like that, he gets accused of being, you know, racist and whatever. So it's pretty ridiculous. What in the world can be done? Actually, you know, I think in the version that we have here, we kind of cut it off there at the end before you started going into the answers. But I think that's really important to talk about. You know, you went into the congressional scorecard, which we have back and whatnot. How important is it for the silent majority to stop being silent? And what do they do, Bill? Is there any hope now?
Well, yes, there's always hope. And what's the alternative? The alternative is just
give up, huh? Yeah.
We're take whatever they give us. And that's a pretty cowardly and short-sighted way of looking at things. We've been given something that is very precious, and it's worth fighting for. So how do you fight for it? You're being told every day that resistance is futile. Don't even try. We know we're being betrayed over and over again by our elected leaders, Republicans just as much as Democrats. In fact, many of the worst things that have happened have come about because Republicans have caved in over and over and over again. And so today we still have all of the big corporations from the Great Reset, from the World Economic Forum. They're all in favor of breaking down borders. And so they are putting a lot of pressure on both Republicans and Democrats. So it's incumbent on each of us to let our representatives and our senators and our state legislators and our governors, because the governors have a lot of power in this, and our state attorney generals, they can be fighting back on this. But most politicians don't lead. They follow. They follow wherever the pressure is coming from. So we need to be putting pressure on them. Let them know when they take a courageous stand, if they are a political figure who is standing up for the right thing, you know they're going to be clobbered by the media. They're going to be attacked as being racist and xenophobes. And so we need to get behind them and say, no, keep going on that path. We're behind you. And we need to support them in those ways. We need to correct them when they're wrong. So that's one of the things that we have to not let up on. And that even goes for our local politicians, for those mayors and city councilmen and county commissioners who are standing up, because we have now a couple hundred sanctuary cities, counties, and other things, because all around the country, the activists, all of these foundation-funded, government-funded activists, have over the decades established their power centers, and they've been able to get local officials to declare their city sanctuary city. So they openly violate the law and bring illegals into the United States, and sometimes even dare the federal authorities to come on and arrest us so that they can then have a George Floyd moment or something like that, where they can create a major protest. So it's time for the silent majority to stop being silent, to wake up.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bill. Thank you for all the work that you've done over the years, and thank you for the work that you continue to do. And that's all the time we have today. For everyone watching, thank you for watching, and have a great weekend. And join us back again on Monday, where we'll be right back, and I'm sure we'll have some updates on what's happened over the weekend. Have a good weekend.